Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, June 18th. Dedication of the Obama Presidential Center got underway this morning. Its doors officially open to the general public tomorrow. Today we hear from Hawaii residents who got a preview tour as part of a leadership program started by the former president. The reflecting pool algae bloom in our nation's capital has us reflecting on our own woes. From the state capitol pools, we get the latest on the ongoing renovations. Kilauea is gearing up for its 50th eruptive episode, the most in the history of the volcano. What scientists are still learning about its mysteries. And we celebrate a small family business who has made beautiful music for 110 years. Got a kamaka ukulele. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. President Barack Obama addressed a crowd at dedication ceremonies in Chicago today for his presidential center. All this week, we have been exploring the Hawaii stories that are told in the museum. Among those who got a preview of the exhibit were fellows of the Obama Foundation Leaders Program. It began back in 2018, and a number of people with Hawaii ties competed for a slot. Today, we hear from two of them. Kepa Barrett is a native Hawaiian educator, and Sheila Sarangi's roots are in Iran. Both are passionate about conservation. They talk about what moved them as they walked through the center earlier this month. Kepa brought his family with him, and they brought lei for staff and shared ole and hula, gifts of aloha. Barrett recalled what it was like seeing the structure for the first time and not knowing what to expect.
It was a very imposing building at first, but on the inside, it was very welcoming and warming, and the angles and the storytelling of the actual museum was second to none, to be quite honest. And I'm just so grateful that I got to bring my whole family with me. And some of the big things that stood out to me were the fact that all of the stories were very personal to both Barack and Michelle Obama. And yet it also was inclusive, if that made sense. So a lot of times when people share their personal stories, we don't necessarily see ourselves in those stories. And especially in today's world where there are leaders, celebrities, people who have a lot of means that share their personal stories, but maybe everyday people like us can't relate to them necessarily. What I appreciated about the Obama Center is that you could see yourself in that center, whether you are from the middle of the Pacific Ocean like I am, or I could imagine if you were in the middle of Manhattan City, there were stories there and aspects of the Obama years that relate to all of us.
What were you most struck by?
I was most struck by the flow of, I think, the actual facility itself. It definitely felt like you were going through period of time that many of us remember, and it struck me how far of a difference we are today in America today. But it reminded me that change is not linear, that there's pendulums, right? It swings back and forth, and that ultimately that particular museum reminded me just how stark of a contrast we can have when we make specific decisions that may or may not align to our personal values, and whether or not we end up showing up for things like our civic responsibilities or civic privileges of voting and whatnot. It really made me realize that, oh, things have been better. Things have also been worse, and things will continue to shift and change as people make different decisions. And it gave me a lot more, I mean, in this sense, it gave me hope, right? It was a stark realization that hope is a superpower in many ways, and it requires us to make those decisions for the betterment of our society as a whole.
I was looking at specifically the Hawaii part of Obama story. What did you zero in on as he started to talk about, you know, his parents and being born and raised here in Hawaii?
Well, so what I appreciated about his stories is actually his relationship to the islands being a multicultural space for him. And there was actually this one essay that he had written back in his grade school age where he actually drew a picture and wrote an essay about King Kamehameha I. And, you know, Hawaii has a long history of civic leaders. And I think that there's definitely a legacy in the air, the water, and our aina here in Hawaii that has definitely informed the way that President Obama has moved forward in his own presidency and as a leader of leaders, you know, in the free world and whatnot. So what I zeroed in on was that particular essay about King Kamehameha I. And then the second thing was actually his relationship with Dr. Maya Satoru Ng, his younger sister. And I've had the privilege of working alongside Maya as a previous Obama fellow in the 25-26 cohort. And the relationship that they have, even though neither of them are Kanaka Maoli by blood, they understand aloha from a very deep sense of their proximity to our culture in Hawaii. And you can just tell that they absolutely love each other and they respect each other, they adore each other, and that they've been through many of the same kinds of, I guess you could say, cultural norms that we're used to here in Hawaii. So having that relationship and his relationship with his parents honed in here in Hawaii and being close in proximity to that is quite powerful, right? So that's something that really stood out to me.
Well, you know, to think that, yeah, someone from Hawaii can rise to the heights that he did in the White House is just so empowering to any little kid who lives in Hawaii, who was born in Hawaii, who is Hapa. And it was just so interesting to see how that experience here helped to bring him up and to bring others up, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's something to say about our, again, I go back to that word proximity with each other. I think in today's world, especially in the virtual world that we live in today, it's very easy for us to other each other, if that makes sense. Like to create a narrative that, oh, these people are so different from me that fundamentally we can't agree on certain value systems, if that makes sense. Whereas, you know, when President Obama was growing up here in Hawaii, because of the proximity that we have to different communities, whether through economic lines or socioeconomic lines, because of our proximity to each other, we had to build power together through economic need, right? It was through survival. And whether we agree with that sentiment or not, in our increased globalized world, we are actually much closer systematically than we have ever been in the species and in the history of the human race. We have never been closer and have had to rely more on each other than at any point prior. Because Barack Obama and his family grew up here in Hawaii, they were exposed to sort of a microcosm of planet Earth in terms of people who come from very different backgrounds, different racial groups, different socioeconomic means. And because of his proximity to people who were just completely different from him, I think that multiculturalism really informed the way that he led in his time in the White House and continues to lead through the Obama Foundation and through the programs that I have been able to benefit from, you know. And I don't think that it was lost on him, his family, or his upbringing. That was a very necessary part of being the first Black president of the United States, being the first multiracial president of the United States, a person of color in the United States, and to rise to the highest levels of global leadership, you have to be able to work with people that are different from you, who think differently from you, and yet seek commonalities that fundamentally we can all agree on.
So do you feel a lot of pressure now, because you are, you know, one of the fellows that have graduated from this program, and there's a lot on your shoulders now?
I don't think it's necessarily pressure. And when I think about pressure, I think that it is a privilege to be an Obama fellow. I don't take that lightly whatsoever. But I also think that what gives me a lot of hope is the fact that I don't necessarily have to do it alone. I think the Asia Pacific region, Obama Leaders Program, that specific region started in 2019. So I am now the fifth cohort of the program. And I know so many other Obama fellows all throughout the world. In fact, one of my coworkers is now my new boss's boss here at Kamehameha Schools. And so I think what gives me a lot of hope, instead of feeling that pressure to perform, is the fact that we're not doing this alone. And even Obama, I'm sure, would agree with this, not to put words in the president's mouth, but I don't think he did everything alone himself. He had great advisors that were on his team that led him and guided him and helped inform his decisions. And so I think that anything that I have to do, or decisions that I have to make in terms of the leadership of the next generation in particular, especially being someone who's in the education space for K through 12, I know I'm not going to make those decisions in a vacuum, if that makes sense. Just because I'm an Obama leader doesn't mean that I have the end all be all say, right? It means that I now have a better toolkit to create a network of people that I can now lean on and check me.
Well, maybe the word should not have been pressure, but maybe kuleana.
Yeah, and kuleana is a privilege, actually. Kuleana, in a sense of the word kuleana in Olalo Hawaii, yes, means responsibility. And that's where the context of the Western and our context of the Hawaii universe sometimes doesn't agree on, right? I think in the Western context, responsibility can be seen as something that is very heavy. And in the context of Hawaii, our kuleana is our identity. We identified ourselves as mahi'ai. We identified ourselves as maka'ainana. We identified ourselves as po'elawai'a, right? These people who were farmers, fishermen, masons, you know, and people who were weavers and whatnot. And so that kuleana that we had to our community was a privilege to have. And people would identify themselves very strongly with their kuleana in ways that were very honorable and dignified. So I think that that helps in terms of the context of what is necessary for leaders in the future, right? Especially for OEB leaders like myself. We were the first storytellers of our land here in Hawaii, and we will continue to be the first in many aspects. Any sort of environmental justice movements or conservation initiatives across the planet, if land is being managed and led and cared for by indigenous people, not just here in Hawaii, but across the world, those lands statistically tend to do better just because they're being managed by people who see the land, the oceans, our waters, and our air as relatives rather than just resources.
Any other, I don't know, final thoughts that you want to share about what you saw and what you experienced about the center and Chicago?
Yeah, I think when it comes to what the center reminded me of is that it was, in our context, it's kind of like a kauhale in Hawaii. A kauhale or a hale halawai is a place where people meet, they share ideas, they share mana'o, they share ike. And I think that the Obama Presidential Center is sort of like that hale halawai, if you will, that meeting house that people from all over the world can come, can learn, can take in ideas, connect with the people that were next to them. It's a great, I think, area to even just sit next to a stranger and share an experience of, wow, this is something that we've had before. It's something that we know is possible again. And not to necessarily despair in any sort of way what the current events might look like. Because again, the long arc of change is long and uneven for a reason. But what I believe is that we have a lot to look forward to in our planet, because that's a decision that I've personally made. And if enough people make that decision personally, then that's where movements happen.
And that was Kepa Barrett, who was one of the fellows who competed for a slot under the Asia Pacific Leadership Program last year. The previous year, Sheila Sarangi was selected under the U.S. program. Here's what she shared about the experience.
I felt very energized when I left. I have a renewed sense of hope, and I felt very inspired. I think that stems from that we're in a moment of time where people in high up positions want to shine a light on our differences and they want to spark chaos and unravel the good work that was really based on values and a lot of community-driven work. And the Presidential Center gave me this renewed hope and energy because it was just this moment to pause and reflect on what America actually stands for, that we're a nation of ordinary people who dare to dream. I love how he says that, right? That our democracy requires us to uphold its principles and to work together towards common goals, that even though we have different origins or skin colors, that we have similar hopes. And I loved all the uplifting quotes. Our destiny is our choice, and the yes, we can in huge letters right when you walked in. And that I'm asking you to believe not in my ability to bring change, but in yours. So we're in a place of threats coming at us, particularly for marine protections. And it was a good reminder of, you got to do the good work. You got to be organizers and dreamers and work together and just keep at it. And that change is incremental and that you just keep showing up every day and doing the hard work. And you have to look at the totality of the work over time too. So
I know that, you did lots of work with the Conservation Council, and in the museum, they talk about the actions that President Obama took to protect Papahanaumokuakea. And some of those efforts are trying to be undone.
Yeah, so last week, President Trump signed a proclamation to roll back portions of protections for Papahanaumokuakea, Mariana Trench, and Muliava or Rose Atoll. And it's an attempt. I mean, it's not longliners and commercial fishers cannot go back into the area now. It will end up going to court. But it's disheartening because this is work that community leaders, Kupuna, and many more over decades and generations have worked to protect these special places.
Yes. I mean, this is something that is important to you, right? And just with all the things that you've seen happen in our community and in our region. So, yeah, I imagine that that's a little disheartening when you see that.
It is. Something that I remind myself, though, of is that this is just a moment in time and that this is intergenerational work. And right now is the time for us to step up to the plate and to uphold these protections. And there will be more people after us. And yeah, I don't know. That's something that brings me kind of peace at the end of a really long day, is that you just do your best each day and you just keep showing up.
Yeah, and I think, too, these times force people to reflect and think, what do we stand for? What are values? What's important? And are you willing to fight for these things?
Yeah, that's right.
And talk about when you were going through this museum and going through the Presidential Center about what else you were struck by.
It really made me reflect on my own journey, that I'm a child of immigrants. My parents are from Iran, and the year that I was born was when the overthrow in Iran happened. And my parents had always intended for all of us to go back. And that unfortunately never happened, as you can see all the current situation that's happening now. So we ended up in Southern California, where I grew up. And I watched my parents really navigate. I watched my parents assimilate, like many people were doing in the 1980s. And it gave me this sense of agency to create the world that we want to live in, that you have to fight for the world that you want around you. And I think that's what brought me to this work. And it was beautiful to see the origins of President Obama and Michelle Obama, that where they came from and their family and their origin stories. And even on, their campaign trail, there was one video of when they were in Iowa, and Michelle Obama is sharing about how she soon came to realize that just like she grew up sitting around the kitchen table talking with her family and, really establishing their values through those conversations, that the people there were doing the same thing. And that the big takeaway is that we are so much more the same than we are different. And that again, America is a place where we hold the destiny, and we just need to keep fighting for the democracy and for the values and for the world that we want to live in.
Kepa talked about he was very fortunate to go back to Chicago and see this exhibit with his family. And I don't know if your parents were able to do that, or, you know, what you shared with them about what you felt after going through this.
I haven't yet. I haven't yet. It's something that I really need to do.
Because it's a very difficult time now. I mean, the peace and the ceasefire is so fragile. And so I'm sure it's a very complicated time for them too, with their emotions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very sensitive time. I mean, we've been holding on to the hope that there will be peace, that I can one day go to Iran and see the country that I'm from for 47 years. And it's really disheartening to see what the state of things are now, that President Trump is saying, I never actually intended on regime change, which is just untrue.
This exhibit is all about connections and whether it's trying to figure ourselves out and our place in the world. You know, we had talked to the library commissioner and how when he saw this, it just resonated. You know, the feelings that the president had when he was growing up here and because of his varied background, that it just really connected him. And I don't know, did you get that same feeling?
You know, something I'll share is that with the Obama Leaders Program, one of the first things that they had us do was to identify our own story and how we got to this work. And it's something that I actually had never done, because as a coalition builder and practitioner and lead, I uplift the stories of other people, particularly Indigenous practitioners across the Pacific. And their intention of doing that was to share that you matter in this work too, and how you bring people to the table. And since the program, it's something that I do regularly. I share about my parents. I share about what inspired me into this work. I share about my upbringing. And I saw so many similarities at the Presidential Center as well of his upbringing and the community organizing work that he did, and then just the values that he has and where he wants to see the direction of America going. So, and something else that I really appreciated was there was a video between Michelle Obama and President Obama where they're sitting down and they're talking story with each other. And she's making these little jabs at him with how old he is. And, you know, when they first met, the kind of car he drove. And it was really very sweet. But something that they said that really resonated with me is that your purpose is ever evolving, that they're still at a stage of understanding their purpose. And I love that there's this recognition that we're all human and that there's more to come. And it's a reminder to ourselves of how important this work is, to have your feet planted and sort of show up every day with a drive and a vision and a mission for the change that you want to see in the world.
And do you feel, I don't know, more pressure now, having gone through the library and that leadership program? I mean,
well, I actually got to go to Papahanaumokuakea 3 weeks ago with Uncle Saul Kohoʻohalahala, who I've been in partnership with for the past 25 years. And I think that weighs on me actually even more now that I have been to the place, now that I've seen the ground beneath my feet that I've been working to protect for so long, that I feel an even stronger kuleana after having heard the sounds of Papahanaumokuakea, after having dove in its beautiful waters, that it's this place that many people will never see, but it's there and it's remarkable. It is a Hawaii that we hope and dream that is still there, and it is.
And it is. We've just heard from Hawaii's Sheila Sarangi. And just before that, Kepa Barrett. They are fellows from the Obama Foundation Leaders Program. Barrett is an educator at Kamehameha Schools. Sarangi is an author and grassroots activist. They were sharing some of their impressions after getting a preview tour of the Obama Presidential Center in Chicago.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land, and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
We know kindness is a good thing. So when we think of doing something nice for someone, why do we so often hold back?
I'm not the first person to suggest that being kind to other people improves well-being, and yet we have tons of opportunities to be kind to other people that we don't take advantage of.
Breaking through the barriers to kindness, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Aloha Air Cargo, connecting Hawaii by providing inter-island shipping with services including Aloha Next Flight Out, Aloha Standard Overnight, and Aloha Economy. AlohaAirCargo.com.
American flag blue. That's what President Donald Trump called the desired hue of the Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool in our nation's capital. It has cost $14 million to fix leaks and other cosmetic issues with the iconic pool in the lead up to the 250th birthday of America. But in recent days, visitors have pointed out the reflecting pool appears more green than blue. It's due to an overgrowth of pesky algae, and it's one of the biggest blooms the pool has ever seen. This reminded us of our own struggles here in Hawaii with greenish, smelly reflecting pools. Algae has been a scourge of the Hawaii State Capitol's reflecting pool since their dedication in 1969. The pools were drained in 2020, but leaks from rainwater persisted into basement offices, the Capitol parking garage, and even the Senate chamber. Keith Regan serves as director of the Department of Accounting and General Services, as well as acting lieutenant governor, and until next Tuesday, acting governor, while Josh Green travels out of state. Regan spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender about the three-phase plan to replace Hawaii's pools with glass and art. He starts with his reaction to the national algae news.
Well, it just brought back a lot of memories in terms of what we've been dealing with here at the state capitol for literally decades, right? Since the building was put into operation back in the late 60s, early 70s, you know, we have been dealing with nothing but algae, or had been dealing with nothing but algae in our own sort of version of the reflecting pool or pools here at the state capitol. So it definitely brought back some memories of the work that was involved in maintaining those pools and trying to address our own algae problems.
Completely. And it seems like you threw everything but the kitchen sink at this problem. I read an article from the early 2000s that talked about chlorine tablets, enzymes, ozone treatments, pumps, and even tilapia at one point.
We literally tried everything, that you listed and probably some things that you didn't, because we wanted to, as much as possible, maintain the water in the pools because that was part of the original design of this capital. Unfortunately, Mother Nature had different plans for us.
And it cost the state to maintain it millions of dollars. It cost millions more to convert it in the plan that's ongoing right now. Do you have updated numbers on the price tag to finally convert the Capitol reflecting pool?
Well, for the work that we have that's being scheduled that involves the pool itself in terms of the, let me back up a little bit, because we're not going to put water back into the pool. We recognize that adding water back into those pools really just sets us up for more problems in the future. And so what we've done is redesign the project so that we give the look and feel of, or, you know, the look of water, but actually not having to deal with the mess and the cleanup of the algae. And so that project, which involves not only finishing the pool itself, but also we're going to be doing some work to the columns. We're going to be doing some work to the what's called the volcano. If you look at the pool, there is sort of this back section that looks like a volcano kind of rising out of the pools. all of those little individual tiles need to be removed and replaced. There's actually a lot of work that's going to be going into this project, and it's about we're estimating somewhere in the $55 to $65 million range in terms of being able to complete what's called phase three of this project. There's probably about 12 or 13 items on this list of work that needs to be done as part of this project. It's actually a very large piece of this final phase of this project.
And I know for so long it was a question of, are we going to keep paying money to maintain the pools and not convert them? It had to be both an economic but also like an artistic and cultural decision too.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, part of that process involved us trying to look at different alternatives. And, you know, we finally landed on the one that made the most sense from a long-term perspective. Adding water back into those pools, not only from a maintenance standpoint, from, you know, keeping it up on a regular basis, but then just also setting us up for future problems where, you know, the waterproofing membrane may eventually fail and cause more leaks down the road. We decided that adding these tiles, which are, you know, essentially glass tiles that give the look of water, would be the best approach for us. And so part of that process involved actually enlisting the help of a local artist, Solomon Enos, who was able to design this incredible interpretation of basically oceans and what you would see in Mother Nature in that environment as part of this overall redevelopment of this, of the glass, which are the tiles on top of the pool space.
Well, do you see parallels with the discussions happening about the Lincoln Memorial Reflecting Pool right now? In 2012, the Obama administration spent $34 million restoring the reflecting pool. And just recently, the push by the second Trump administration cost $14 million to renovate the pool and install what they call an ozone nanobubbler to try to prevent some of this algae growth. Do you see reverberations there from the types of decisions that the state of Hawaii had to make over its capital pools?
I think we learned a big lesson, which is that, you know, in a warm environment like the one that we're in here in Hawaii, with the depth of the pool itself and the challenges that we face with, you know, wildlife adding to sort of nutrients, if you will, to the water, that adding water back in is not going to be the solution, because we're going to end up having to throw more money, good money after bad, essentially, to continuously maintain this water environment. By changing direction and actually creating something that, one, doesn't require actual water, but gives the look of water, essentially achieves the same thing, right? But without sort of that ongoing, regular, costly maintenance that a pool would have. In addition, the difference between our pool and, let's say, the reflecting pool in Washington, D.C., is that we actually have active office space beneath our pools. So placing a pool or water feature on top of basically a building creates long-term problems, right, and potential for risk. So, you know, adding that water back into our state capital pools really just did not make sense. We wanted to find a solution that was going to be a long-term fix for this pool that was going to provide longevity and reduce maintenance costs, as well as create an environment where the people of our community will be able to enjoy this space in a way that has never been envisioned in the past. So it does a number of different things for us. Most importantly, it is going to restore that space into an incredibly beautiful and attractive place where families and community members can gather and utilize it in ways that it was never dreamed of.
Do you have any advice for the folks in D.C. right now trying to clear out the algae in the Lincoln Memorial Pool?
I wish them all the best.
Okay.
That's about all that I can share at this point.
Anything else to add right now?
We're just really excited about this project. We are out to bid right now on this project. We're looking forward to getting proposals back in the next couple of months. We anticipate that by August, beginning of August, if everything goes as planned, we should be opening those bids and being able to move forward with this exciting project for the state of Hawaii.
That was State Comptroller Keith Regan talking about the multi-million dollar effort to replace Hawaii State Capitol reflecting pools. Halfway to 100, Kilauea volcano is forecast to start its 50th eruptive episode next week. This current eruption began in December of 2024. It has had more episodes than any other in Kilauea's history, and the volcano is showing no signs of slowing down. HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote spoke with geophysicist Ingrid Johansson and geologist Drew Downs about Kilauea's record-breaking streak and what insights it has offered into the volcano's behavior. Johansson starts us off.
I would not have anticipated 50 fountaining episodes when we were at episode one. We had already had a couple summit eruptions, and my guess would have been, you know, another summit eruption in the pattern that had already been established. But yeah, what we've seen in the last year and a half has been unprecedented.
And Drew, on that point, has it changed how you and your colleagues understand the way that Kilauea operates and erupts?
Yes, absolutely. There's several different styles of eruptions from Kilauea. And broadly speaking, eruptions fall into two categories. You have effusive eruptions, which are just your lava flows, and you have your explosive eruptions, which is where you get tephra, these particles that can be bigger than your head to very tiny flowery grains that fall. And we've seen both in the last couple of years, and they're driven by a variety of things, gas content, how much liquid you have, how much solid in the form of crystals you have coming out. And we've seen both now, and this is kind of unprecedented what we're seeing at the summit. We don't have in historical times anything quite like what we're seeing now at the summit with these 50 episodes. Of course, Kilauea Iki back in 1959 had 17 episodes, but over a much shorter time span. And, you know, we don't know how much longer this could go on. It's got to end eventually, but it shows no signs of slowing down.
And broadly speaking, what kind of research opportunities have come out of having such a extended eruptive period?
One of the main ones is tephra distribution. Over the last couple of years, and even before with Pu'o'o and the Halema'uma'u lava lake, a lot of the eruptions have been very effusive. So we've got lava flows. We're very good at looking at lava flows and being able to study those, collect samples, and kind of come up with models for what's going to happen. This has really let us dig into things that are thrown into the air. So again, that tephra, which tephra is just anything that falls through the air and gets swept up by the wind. And there's not a whole lot of research that's been done on tephra deposits from Hawaii. We know there's older tephra. So the Kiana-Kakoi tephra sequence, which occurred from about 1500 to the early 1800 AD. But even with some of these lava fountains that occurred at Pu'o'o, Mauna'ulu in the 80s and the 70s and back to Kilauea Iki in the 50s, there weren't modern monitoring techniques like we've got now, where we've got a lot of tilt meters that Ingrid looks at. We've got a lot of seismometers. We've got a lot of infrasound, but we've also got a lot more satellites that are peering down at Kilauea all the time. We've got a lot of, you know, Doppler radar out at Nalehu and other techniques we can use to look at and model what's going on with these eruptions that previously, just decades ago, we couldn't do. And we're getting a much better understanding of how the lava rips itself apart as it's thrown in the air and drifts around the atmosphere.
And Ingrid, turning to you, Drew said, we don't know when this is going to end necessarily, but we are able to look ahead as to when we anticipate the next episode is going to be. Episode 50 might occur as soon as June 24th. Tell us how we're able to know that. How are we able to look ahead like that?
Yeah. One of the unique things about this eruption has been how consistently the fountaining has started. So there was a very consistent level of ground deformation that we were coming back to for each fountaining episode. What this indicates is that there's a very consistent pressure level within the magma chamber that is needed in order to start fountaining. So tilt meter is the instrument that we look at for this. When we see a tilt meter reach a certain point, that's an indication that the pressure in the magma chamber is now at the right level to start a fountaining episode. And this is unique because this is not necessarily how every episodic fountaining eruption behaves. It's how this fountaining eruption is behaving. So our ability to provide these forecasts really is in part because of this unique behavior of the volcano as, you know, coming back to this very consistent pressure level again and again. You know, that's part of the reason why, you know, it's not clear when or how this would end, because we keep seeing ourselves coming back to this consistent level and then fountaining, back to the level and then fountaining.
Have there been any broad changes over the course of this year and a half of episodes where there have been periods with perhaps more emissions or more ashfall that we have observed?
There's been some changes in terms of which vents have been active at the summit. There's two vents that are typically involved in the fountaining, the north vent and the south vent. And there was a period of time where it was not uncommon for both of them to produce fountains at the same time. And that was the period of time where we had really high fountaining, lots of volume being erupted. But for the last about five episodes, it's been only the north vent that's been fountaining. And we've seen somewhat lower heights and lower volumes. So there are some interesting sort of phases that the volcano has gone through that will be interesting to kind of piece together what might be influencing those phases.
And this is Drew. I'd just like to add, I've mentioned that there's been fountaining in the past, Kilauea Iki in 1959, Mauna Ulu in 1969, 1970, and Pu'o'o from 1983 through 1986 all had fountaining. But what was different about those three compared to what's going on now is that each of those produced a single fountain. They were episodic, but it was one fountain. This is really unique in that we have two fountains really close together going off at the same time for a lot of these episodes. And not only for Kilauea, but worldwide, that's something that just hasn't been seen, two fountains that are, you know, 100 yards apart that are shooting up sometimes 300-400 meters high into the air at the same time. And it doesn't do that for every episode, but it's done it for a lot of these episodes. And being able to explain why that happens is still one of the kind of outstanding questions we have of how are these magmatic conduits at depth connected to each other, and what's controlling why one goes off and one doesn't, or both go off at the same time.
The big question mark that I'm taking away from this conversation is we don't know when these eruptive episodes may stop. But would there be signs that you folks are looking for that would indicate, okay, we might be winding this chapter down?
So it's unlikely that Kilauea will ever stop. Kilauea just changes. So most of what we're looking for is signs that magma might be going into a different part of the volcano. So in particular, you know, keeping a very close eye on the East Rift Zone, where eruptions from the East Rift Zone can threaten a number of the communities on Hawaii Island. Like looking for changes in seismicity that might indicate magma going somewhere else, either the East Rift Zone or the Southwest Rift Zone. Certainly looking for ground deformation that might indicate magma starting to intrude into other parts of the volcano. But that is the expectation, not so much that activity might stop, but that activity might change.
That was Ingrid Johansson and Drew Downs with the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory. They spoke with HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Kilauea is expected to erupt again as soon as June 23rd.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Gas, offering tips to help local residents and businesses prepare for natural disasters and emergencies. Learn more at hawaiigas.com/safety.
Apply to join Hawaii Public Radio's Community Advisory Board. Volunteers from across the islands advise HPR on programming and outreach and help shape the future of HPR. Nominate yourself or someone else. Apply by Friday, June 26 at hawaiipublicradio.org/CAB.
Support for HPR comes from the State Office of Elections, reminding eligible residents to register, confirm, or update mailing addresses for the August 8th primary election. More at elections.hawaii.gov.
Music filled the air on the top floor of Honolulu Hale yesterday, and Hawaii Public Radio was there. Take a listen. Those were the sounds of a kamaka ukulele. The spotlight was on the company as, for more than a decade and a century ago, it was started by Sam Kamaka Sr. The ukuleles are manufactured at its factory on South Street. The third-generation family business is guided by Chris Kamaka Sr., who thanked his family, his siblings, and their spouses for helping to continue the long-standing tradition of making the jumping flea. The instrument has its roots in Portugal and has ties to the plantation era of sugar and pineapple. Honolulu Mayor Rick Blangiardi officially proclaimed today Kamaka Ukulele Day in honor of the master craftsman.
Whereas for 110 years, Kamaka Hawaii has preserved a tradition of handcrafted ukulele making, passing its knowledge and craftsmanship through generations while maintaining a steadfast commitment to quality, innovation, and excellence. And whereas Kamaka Hawaii is widely recognized across the city and county of Honolulu, throughout Hawaii and around the world as the king of the ukulele.
And we got a chance to sit down with Chris Kamaka Jr. at the Kaka'ako factory there on South Street. He's vice president of the family business, and he's a luthier, like his dad and uncle and grandfather. You can tell he loves the craft of creating. The company produces some 1,500 ukulele each year.
It's a special day. It's also my grandpa's birthday, so he would have been 104 this year. But yeah, it's just a huge milestone for us. It makes you think of all the past employees we had, all the family members that came through that built it up to where it is today, you know, my grandma and my grandpa. So yeah, hopefully we're making them proud today.
And so you make ukulele. Describe to our listeners what it means when you put an ukulele together. I mean, we're sitting here and there's shelves of wood, you know, up to the ceiling here.
Yeah, so, you know, most of our instruments are from a native Hawaiian tree, the koa tree. So we take the koa tree, mostly from the Big Island of Hawaii in the high elevations. We come here, we process the wood, and then from a big log, we turn it into quarter-inch sets, which eventually becomes a top and a back and a pair of sides. And slowly we create a kamaka ukulele.
And I'm looking at these boxes. It's Jake and Tenor 5, Ota, Ota-san, concert.
Yeah, so all of the different models we have, I can't even name how many models we have now, but there's so many different ones. And you can see all the different types of woods we have here. So not just koa wood, but, you know, mango wood, monkey pod, rosewood, ebony, spruce, cedar, all different types of woods we use as well.
You know, I recall interviewing a luthier from Paris, and he created an ukulele with a D-hole because he played gypsy jazz, and that was what they did and how, you know, how they played. It was more a D-hole for a guitar, but he just loved the ukulele and just loved the sound, you know, because it is magical.
Yeah, it is, and it's each instrument is unique too, you know, like they may all come from the same tree. If you make 10 from the same tree, each one will sound different. Each one is very unique.
What was the most difficult thing, you think, when you were starting out making ukuleles? Because there's something about the feel, right? and the sound.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it's easy to go through the motions, but like, because, you know, wood is so different, like each type of wood is different grain, a different density, different colors. So, you know, you really have to put in the effort to, you know, adjust the way you make each instrument. You know, some darker woods, you know, you go a little lighter on the bracing. Different sanding, you know, like when the body is assembled, there's a lot of tapping that goes through. So a lot of that is learned, passed down from my grandpa. And yeah, so that vibration you feel, that's a little more, you know, attention to detail we do when we, but yeah, making it sound good is probably the hardest part. Making it pretty is a little more fun to do, yeah.
And then I know this is going to be the anniversary coming up for the pineapple ukulele.
Yeah.
And I think your dad gave us some sneak previews of some designs that you're working on with Aulani.
Yep,
and yeah,
yep.
It's just really neat to see, you know, how you folks are, I guess, evolving and then also paying homage to the history.
Yeah. So the pineapple, I think it'll turn 100 years in 2028. But yeah, it's funny though, kind of like an experiment my grandpa was doing because he couldn't bend the ukulele shape. It kind of looked like a pineapple. So that's kind of how he created it. And, you know, he patented it. Then the patent eventually ran out. So you see other people making it. But yeah, we were the first ones to make that. And yeah, to see how popular it is now today, you know, it's really associated with like those old school, you know, kind of like the Tiny Tim days, you know, that small instrument sound. For our 100 years, we kind of made a custom one. So it was kind of really decked out in shell and stuff, but it's still paid homage to like the original label we had inside. So we took that original label, we made it into like a stone instead.
Anything else you would like to share with our listeners? You know, because it's a big deal for the family, big deal for the company. And yeah, you want people to just kind of, you know, enjoy the tradition and the customs that you folks have been able to keep going.
Of course. Yeah, I would encourage everyone to come down to the shop. We have tours every day. So come check it out, see how it's made, see all the new models we're coming out with. You know, we also have a line of Aloha shirts or Aloha wear we just paired with Manuheli, which is out now. But yeah, a lot of fun stuff going on, new stuff, and then also our gala that's coming up on July 10th. Yeah, so celebrating our 110th year at this gala, Ukulele, International Ukulele Festival Gala, and then they're featuring all of our Kamaka artists. So they were nice enough to allow us to feature some of our artists, and that will take place on July 10th.
So it's a big deal event, a big splash, just to honor the history.
Yeah, to you know, honor where we're at now, feature some of our artists that take our instruments around the world. And yeah, just celebrate our company.
All right, and hopefully you'll be around for another 110 years.
Yeah, hopefully. Can't mess it up.
As part of the company's plan to stick around for another century or two, it is working to strengthen its Japan market, and it has just rolled out a new model made with mahogany at a more affordable price point. Look for the Kukui ukulele at the Kaka'ako factory and retail shop. And that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we'll have special programming in place for the Juneteenth holiday. We do welcome feedback. Caller talkback line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Want to listen back to something you heard? Find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us next week for more of The Conversation.